Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Today, our show is crammed full of information. Let me ask you, what important museums are there in Chicago other than the Art Institute, the Field Museum, and the Museum of Science and Industry? You know, those are the three that get all the publicity. But the answer to my question to you is that there are a number of very interesting museums, and a visit to them will be very rewarding, with a rich and storied history at literally every corner. Chicago is home to many diverse cultures, with neighborhoods once inhabited by immigrants from all walks of life. The city is a mecca for cultural traditions that span generations. And here are some cultural museums that explore and honor each of these cultures' unique experiences. I'm going to begin with the DuSable Museum. The DuSable Black History Museum and Education Center, formerly the DuSable Museum of African American History, is a Washington Park-based museum which is dedicated to the study and conservation of African American history, culture, and art. It opened in 1961. The DuSable is the oldest independent African American museum in the United States. It has been a center for culture and arts, as well as for research and education. Today, the museum houses over 15,000 pieces and includes paintings, sculptures, print works, and historical memorabilia. The museum also frequently hosts special exhibitions, workshops, and lectures. At this time, more than 100,000 people visit the museum each year. I'll give you the phone number of the museum and then get directions as to how you can visit it and when it is open. The phone number in Chicago is 773-947-0600. Another museum that is well worth visiting is the National Museum of Mexican Art. It was formerly known as the Mexican Fine Arts Center Museum. The National Museum of Mexican Art in Chicago's Pilsen neighborhood features Mexican, Latino, and Chicano art and culture. It was founded in 1982. Its mission is to stimulate knowledge and appreciation of Mexican art and culture by means of Mexican art, visual and performing arts, high quality arts education and resources, and professional development of Mexican artists. Well worth the visit, as is the DuSable Museum. And the phone number for the Museum of Mexican Art is 312-738-1503. And then there's the Polish Museum of America. The Polish Museum of America is located within the headquarters of the Polish Roman Catholic Union of America in Chicago's West Town, a formerly predominant and historical Polish neighborhood. The museum has plenty of permanent exhibitions, like its maritime room, which features a collection of model ships and memorabilia. Its military collection that displays uniforms and medals and other war materials. And its Helena Modjeska exhibit, the collection of theater costumes and other artifacts surrounding a famous Polish-American Shakespearean actress. So here is a rich collection of Polish artifacts, like artwork and embroidered folk garments. The Polish Museum of America hosts cultural programs such as lectures and theater performances, and conducts public programming in collaboration with other museums, educational institutions, and cultural centers. So give them a call at 773-384-3352. And then maybe one more museum, and it is the Chinese American Museum. The Chinese American Museum, with permanent and rotating exhibits, the museum tells the stories of immigrant journeys, work, and customs, including an annual Chinese New Year celebration, which features traditional Chinese music, food, and dancing. It also hosts frequent film screenings. So, Chinese American Museum, at the following phone number is 312-949-1000. So if you've seen the other museums that get all the attention, like the Field and the Museum of Science and Industry and the Art Institute, remember that you have a handful, in fact, more than a handful of museums of this kind. And for that, we'll stop for a moment and be right back. Don't go away. We want you here to hear the rest of the program. We're back with the Erie Canal. Former President Thomas Jefferson considered the proposal a little short of madness. This proposal was for a project known as Clinton's Folly, an embarrassment to the state of New York and its governor, DeWitt Clinton. Yet, shortly after the locks opened in 1825, completing a man-made waterway that connected the Hudson River to the Great Lakes, the critics were silenced, and the Erie Canal, one of the greatest engineering marvels in history, charted America's course from colonial startup to a global superpower. But going back a few years, in 1807, commercial interests in New York started agitating for a canal to link the Midwest and the Eastern Seaboard. A transportation corridor to the Great Lakes would open the nation's interior to global trade and would promote the development of an American heartland. Raw materials would come east, people would move west. In Clinton's hopeful words at the canal's opening ceremony, he said, "The most fertile and extensive regions of America will avail themselves of its facilities for a market, and New York City will, in the course of time, become the greenery of the world, the emporium of commerce, the seat of manufactures, the focus of great moneyed operations." Easier said than done. America had few civil engineers at the time. Equipment was crude. William Otis wouldn't patent his industrial steam shovel until 1839, and Alfred Nobel's dynamite wouldn't appear until 1866. So muscle would build the canal. Construction began in 1817, and soon Benjamin Wright, a prominent surveyor, became the chief engineer. Clinton's daughters were correct that the engineering challenges were unprecedented. Wright's roughly 9,000 laborers channeled nobly through impossible rock formations. Sometimes they'd crack the stone with gunpowder, a volatile and deadly option. At other times, they would use a drill bit invented just for the task. To dig the canal trench, 4 feet deep, 40 feet wide, running 363 miles from Albany to Buffalo, the men used picks and shovels. There were intense risks, malaria, mysterious illnesses, and grisly construction accidents disabled hundreds of workers and killing many. Furthermore, the greatest challenge was elevation. Elevation, height above sea level. Because Lake Erie, the canal's western terminus, is more than 570 feet above sea level. The Hudson River at Waterford, New York, the eastern terminus, is a mere 16 and a half feet. Given rises and dips along the way, the engineers knew the canal couldn't be a continuous river. It would have to be arranged in a series of waterways, and each one would occupy its own elevation. With those strips connected by locks, great concrete bathtubs, designs for which Wright and other engineers copied from the finest English and French canal builders of the day. A boat floats in, the doors close, and piped water flows into or out of the sealed chamber, raising or lowering the water level so the vessel can float on to the next stretch. Once complete, it would be one of the longest canals in the world. After the canal opened in October of 1825, economic gains were swift and helped to transform New York City, which was roughly 150 miles down the Hudson River from Waterford, into the nation's premier seaport, surpassing Philadelphia and Boston. The Canal Corridor also served as an important route on the Underground Railroad. Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass lived nearby, and they were able to provide refuge to those in flight. The canal wasn't just an engineering feat. It was a community linked by water and by the belief in a better tomorrow. The 1912 song, "Low Bridge, Everybody Down," perhaps known as 15 Miles on the Erie Canal, offered the country a nostalgic vision of the plucky life on the barges, and it was a celebration of the booming canal cities that helped turn New York into the Empire State. A lot of people look at the canal as history today, but according to one lock operator at Waterford, we're still here. We're still here. The canal remains a playground and a testament to American engineering. At once a call to adventure and a gentle edict to slow down and unplug. Life in the slow lane is the canaler's motto today. Along several stretches, the motorized speed is a mere 5 miles per hour. Life in the slow lane, eh? Well, we'll be right back. And we're going on to the third item of today's show. And now, the frontier that wasn't. Frederick Jackson Turner, the historian, gave America its most enduring national mythology. And then he changed his mind. Well, in today's program, I probably will only be able to tell you about the first part of this story, and I'll finish up on the next program. On the evening of July the 12th, 1893, in the hall of a massive new Beaux-Arts building that would soon become the house of the Art Institute of Chicago, a young professor named Frederick Jackson Turner rose to present what would become the most influential essay in the study of American history. Frederick Jackson Turner. Turner told the audience that the force forging Americans into one people was the frontier of the Midwest and Far West. In this virgin world, settlers had finally been relieved of the European baggage of feudalism that their ancestors had brought across the Atlantic, freeing them to find their true selves. They're self-sufficient, pragmatic, egalitarian, and civic-minded. The frontier promoted the formation of a composite nationality for the American people. In the crucible of the frontier, the immigrants were Americanized, they were liberated, and they were fused into a mixed race. English in neither nationality nor characteristics. At the time, the audience was unmoved. Yet in less than a decade, Turner would be the most influential living historian in the United States. And his frontier thesis would become the dominant lens through which Americans understood their character, their origins, and their destiny. Soon, Jackson's theme was prevalent in political speech, in the way that high schools taught history and in patriotic paintings. In short, everywhere. Perfectly timed to meet the needs of a country experiencing dramatic and destabilizing change. Turner's thesis was swiftly embraced by the academic community and political institutions, just as railroads, manufacturing machines, and telegraph systems were rapidly reshaping American life. By that time, Turner himself had realized that his theory was almost entirely wrong. American historians had long believed that Providence had chosen their people to spread Anglo-Saxon freedom across the continent. As an undergraduate at University of Wisconsin, Turner was introduced to a different argument by his mentor, the classical scholar William Francis Allen. Extrapolating from Darwinism, Allen believed that societies evolved like organisms, adapting themselves to the environment they encountered. Scientific laws and not divine will, he advised his mentee, guided the course of nations. And after graduating, Turner pursued a doctorate at Johns Hopkins University, where he impressed the history program's leader, Herbert Baxter Adams, and they formed a lifelong friendship. The connections were useful. When Allen died, Adams and Wilson aided Turner in the quest to take Allen's place at the head of Wisconsin's Department of History. And on the strength of Turner's early work, they invited him to present a paper at the 1893 meeting. And that was to be held in conjunction with the World Congress, auxiliary of the World Olympian Exposition. And there we'll have to stop for today's program. I'll leave you hanging, wondering what happens next. Well, Woodrow Wilson, a former president, is also involved in this story. And next time, I'll tell you what Turner believed was different. He did not accept his first theory, but he was to change it considerably and spent much of his life trying to accumulate information and to write in support of this. He didn't succeed. But that's another story. I want you to come back, hear the end of this Frontier Thesis story. You be safe. Take care now. Be kind to each other. As Willie Nelson and I end the program by going down the road again, looking for items to include in our next program after we finish the Frontier Thesis. You be safe now and welcome the spring. We need it. Goodbye.